There is a story of a man in Loveland, Texas. True story. He had his dog lost. He got his lost dog back after he put the following ad in the newspaper. Lost or strayed, Chihuahua dog answering to the name of Chico. Brilliant dog, acutely aware of national and world politics. He shakes all the time. That really appeared in a paper some years back. You know, this past week, September the 10th, was World Suicide Prevention Day. Statistics show that over the last 15 years, suicide has really been on the rise in the United States at an alarming rate. Studies suggest there are a lot of factors that contribute to that increase. I was looking those over and studying it through, and I noticed something about all of those factors. They all have something in common, that is lost hope. Whether that's caused by mental illness or problems in relationships, financial stresses, other things, or combinations of other things, all of them are things that lead to a person losing hope. Hope that there is a way out. Hope that things are going to get better. Hope that somebody is going to care. And they lose hope. Like never before, I see us living in a world that has lost hope. The arriving generations are missing it. There is no real hope for national security. We were reminded of that, by the way, this past week also on 9/11. Not real hope that the drug crisis is going to end. Not real hope that we're going to cure poverty or that there's going to be real peace in the world. When was the last time that you watched or read the news and you got the sense that hope is just around the corner? Not. And then I read a letter called 1 Peter where he puts these words in the introduction. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. According to his great mercy, he has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. The general message of this letter we call 1 Peter is a message of hope, real hope. Late 1920s, there was a show by a guy named Al Pierce. How many of you remember Al Pierce? All right. He did a character named Elmer Blurt, the world's most nervous door-to-door salesman. And the running gag of Al Pierce and Elmer Blurt was he'd approach a house, he'd knock on the door and say, "Nobody home, I hope, I hope, I hope." And that became a national catchphrase. In fact, we use a catchphrase today that shows our anemic view of what hope is all about. You ever say that you hoped for something and then said, knock on wood. Some people knock on their head, knock on wood. And what that means to us, I think, is we're saying if all goes well, if we're lucky, if we somehow dodge Murphy's Law, things might just possibly turn out to be okay. Maybe. Probably. But when Peter talks about hope in this letter, 1 Peter, by the way, we're going to be looking at that book today. Typically, when we talk about hope, what we really mean is, I have a wishful thought that things might turn out okay, but I really don't control it. So I am saying I hope, but that doesn't change anything. Peter's going to teach us something about hope that's different. This letter, 1 Peter, is a letter about hope, real hope. Real hope that's based on the certainties of God. Real hope that is about things that are reliable and true, that they just aren't here yet. That's why it's called hope. And to introduce this letter today, we're just going to look at what real hope can produce in our lives, what it ought to produce in our lives. Remember the fruit of the Spirit: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Those are the things that ought to come out in a Christian's life because the Holy Spirit is living inside. Peter shows us in this letter that there are some fruits, if you will, of real hope that ought to come out in our lives if we have real hope in God. And what I want to say today is that our hope comes from the Lord and it produces real fruit in our lives. I want us to leave here today with a better sense of real hope. For instance, one of the fruits that ought to come out in our lives is obedience to God's design. Boy, yesterday during the car show, there were some really neat cars here. And I like to go around and marvel at some of the intricate designs that come together in a car. I mean, there are just some really amazing things that have been engineered and put together that teams of, oh, how'd that get up there? I had my car in the show yesterday. Pretty amazing things that people put together. Engineers, craftsmen, financiers, factory designers, assembly line workers. It's incredible. But you know what? We would never, as a human race, we would never have been able to come up with all of that if we hadn't been able to observe design and structure in creation first. That's where we got those ideas. We never would have put these things in order if God hadn't done it for us in the first place. And the way we mess them up when we neglect His design helps prove that. I know that a lot of it's not on purpose, but we sure goof some things up sometimes. And one answer to those mess ups is hope. Hope helps us stick to God's design. Peter's really specific about how it can help us. For instance, in a family, it helps us stick to God's design in a family. Marriage counselor was sitting speaking with a woman, asked her, "Has your husband lived up to all the things he said before you were married?" She said, "Well, no, not all, but he has lived up to one of them." "Which one was that?" he asked. "He said he wasn't good enough for me." Start digging through this letter, and one of the things I find out is that real hope helps shape a healthy marriage. Not the high hopes that you take into marriage on the day of the wedding, but real hope that comes from God. There were some women in the early church who had apparently become followers of Jesus, but their husbands had not. That's a tough situation. And that can put some stress into a relationship. Listen to what Peter tells wives that hope will do for their marriage, even if it's a difficult marriage like that. Chapter 3, verse 1, "Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives, when they see your respectful and pure conduct. Do not let your adorning be external, the braiding of hair, the putting on of gold jewelry, or the clothing you wear. But let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. For this is how the holy women who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, by submitting to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. And you are her children if you do good and do not fear anything that is frightening." Why should a wife have her hope be in God? What should she have? One thing she should have is the ability to carry out this command of God. Now, in a minute, we're going to look at how husbands can help that. But right now, notice again, verse 1, Peter has the nerve to suggest to you ladies this morning that you be a submissive wife, even if your husband isn't a believer. Now, what good could that do? According to him, it could save his soul for eternity. That's what good it could do. What's more likely to interest a man in life with God? Nagging and threatening him that he'd be better if he'd straighten out? Or an attitude that clearly says, guess what? The God that I serve commands me to be this way, and I'm going to work on being the woman he commands me to be, not just to please you, but because my loyalty is first to him. That's the way for happiness in our home. Some might be thinking, well, that's nice, but that would not work in my home. Let me give you a little hope this morning from church history. There were no roots of Christianity in the Scandinavian countries very early in church history. In fact, those Norskies were a rugged, invading kind of people who would come down into Europe and conduct raids and often grab women from the villages that they would pillage, take them back and marry them, take them off as wives. And while there were no missionary efforts there at first, there appears in history a small growth of Christianity among the Norse people. And the reason? Because the captured women had converted their husbands. Remember your hope, Christian wives. Verse 5, this is how the holy women who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, by submitting to their husbands. Your hope can make you children of Sarah, who followed Abraham's lead even when he was wrong. Well, of course he was wrong. He was married. Let me ask you this morning, do you hope enough in God to be so bold? Do it without any fear. Let your hope in God show its colors. Husbands, don't miss your part in this. Verse 7. Likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered. Men, your hope in God should help you look at that woman in a way that is different than other husbands look at their wives. She is a special person with special qualities, and she is to be treated with special care for that reason. You know, when God made Eve, he made her out of the same stuff he made Adam out of, but he didn't make her just like Adam, and I'm thankful for that. I discovered that my wife isn't just like me. She's able to be sensitive to things that I fail to notice. She can interpret unspoken languages that I don't even hear. She is able to engage little people in a way that escapes me. And I can still take her in an arm wrestle. Now, my fellow heir of grace that I live with is a, yes, weaker vessel. And I praise God for it. I couldn't stand it if she was just like me. But the hope that I have in God is the same hope that she has. And we're equals when it comes to salvation. We're on the same level there. My hope in God helps me to be obedient to his order for our household, which means for me to love her the way that Christ loves his church, and for her to follow my lead. And yes, it does work. This also produces some fruit for church members. If there's one place where our hope ought to be evident in obedience, it's in the family of God. Part of our hope is based on the fact that God has made us, if you look at chapter 2, verse 9, the chosen race, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession. That is our very real hope in the church, and it needs to show. So Peter writes in verse 11, "Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh, which wage war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation." Yes, our hope in God should, must make a difference in our lifestyles, make them noticeably distinct, to a point where people on the outside look in, people who come to a car show watch us, and they make a note of it. I wonder what Peter would say to the church in the United States today if he was writing a letter? Why is it that we so often work at being like the world when what we really ought to be putting our effort into is somehow sticking out? Why are problems with pornography so prevalent in the church in the United States? Why is the divorce rate nearly the same in the church as out in some parts of the country? Why don't our co-workers, our classmates, our family members know that we're living day to day by a different worldview? I wonder what Peter would write to the church. Do we hope for the very same things that the people on the outside of the church are hoping for? More money, more power, more pleasure, more time to enjoy all of that? Come on, church. Real hope that comes from God, demands from us a life that looks different. The fruit of obedience in the church. Okay, put your shoes back on. I'm done stepping on your toes. It also means the fruit of obedience for citizens. Just like a wife can show her hope in God by submitting to her imperfect husband, we have an obligation to show our hope in God by submitting to, here it is, an imperfect human government. Yeah, I heard the groans. Look at chapter 2, verse 13. Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Your life as a citizen, wherever that may be, is a reflection on your hope that you have in God. By the way, that's another reason that we have for not putting our hope in any human government. Our hope is in God. Somewhere out there right now is a wave of thinking going around. You see it growing. You see it every day. The idea is that if you don't agree with something, if you don't like the way that it's being done, take to the streets. Create chaos. Disobey. Destroy resources. Disrespect. Stick it to the man, whoever he is. If ever there was a group of people who could protest the way that they were being treated by the government, it was Christians in the first century Roman Empire. They were never instructed to take to the streets. That's not what God was telling them to do. But they were never instructed to do that. They were instructed simply to obey civil authorities. Christians were, during that day, as Peter writes to them, wrongly being accused of being insurrectionists. Simply wasn't true. Instead, Peter told them, by doing good, they could silence the ignorance of foolish people. Be model citizens. There were times for civil disobedience, but those were extreme. In general, here's the message of God to his people about their citizenship. Be obedient. Be good citizens. Our obedience to the government shows our hope is beyond that of the average citizen. Let your hope make a difference in the kind of citizen you are. It helps us to be obedient because this honors God. It shows that submission to his plan is our first pledge of allegiance, no matter where we live. Another fruit that real hope will produce is long-suffering. It'll produce obedience in our lives. It ought to. Another one is long-suffering. That is to have patience when times are tough. Some of us need that more than others right now. Long-suffering. I have a nephew who has been in the ministry for over 20 years now. And not too long ago, he was offered a job as a partner in a funeral home business. It would have been a lot more lucrative. He was actually interested in it. The guy offering it to him was a good friend. And he had to take a hard look at it to decide whether or not he was going to continue preaching where he's at. I wondered if he might not do it, though. He decided to go ahead and keep preaching. And I'm glad. I think he's a good preacher. But he decided not to do that, and I thought maybe he might do it, because I'd heard the story of a preacher who, after 20 years, decided to become a funeral director. And when he was asked why he changed, here's what he said. I spent 3 years trying to straighten out John, and John is still an alcoholic. I spent a year trying to straighten out Susan's marriage. She filed for a divorce. Then I spent 2.5 years trying to straighten out Bob's anger problem, and he's still just as angry as he ever was. And now at the funeral home, when I straighten people out, they stay straight. Long-suffering, some of us need more than others. Just depends where you're at in life, I suppose. Peter's writing to a group of people who need long-suffering. They need to be reminded that hope will produce this in their lives. They're being persecuted because of their faith. Look at chapter 1, verse 6. In this you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials. Chapter 4, verse 12. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you as though something strange were happening to you. These people were facing some pressure. In the middle of suffering because of their faith, they needed help to make it through. And Peter was helping them to do that by reminding them of, guess what? Their hope in God. Hope produces long suffering in our lives when times are tough. But we're not under a corrupt Roman government that'll soon be killing Christians for public entertainment. Does this even apply to us? I'm glad you asked that. Let me remind you that worldwide, more people have died for their faith in Jesus Christ in the past century than in all centuries previous, combined. Let me remind you that people are being imprisoned and tortured and dying in communist countries now. Let me remind you that persecution in India in the past few years has quadrupled. And then there's the slow crush that is being applied to our own doorsteps. There's the legal pressure that has us changing our bylaws a couple of years ago to cover our bases here at Central. There's the worry that government policy changes against the church that we see around us will gain momentum in the country. Think about that. What would happen if nationwide your church contribution was no longer considered an eligible tax break? Just think about that. What if all of the negative talk against sinful lifestyles was suddenly labeled hate speech and made illegal? What if we suddenly had to give equal time to all kinds of false religions and philosophies? This isn't so far removed, is it? Doesn't real hope have a place in the way that we handle what's going on today and in the future right around us? I don't know what's down the road for our children and grandchildren. I don't know how soon that is going to come. I just know that our hope in God is going to help us endure hardship for the sake of honoring Him. We need to get a grip on real hope. Peter says in chapter 4, verse 19, therefore let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good. Folks, our God is faithful. We can trust He'll take care of the details when we stick our necks out for Him. Hope should naturally result in long-suffering when hard times come. One more fruit of hope, and that is outspokenness. That's just a natural outcome. When somebody has convictions that lead to obedience, when their obedience has led to enduring opposition, it naturally leads to being an outspoken person. One of the things I enjoy about the car show is walking around and talking to car enthusiasts. I'm not a car enthusiast. I'm a car admirer, but I'm not an enthusiast. Some of these guys have spent hours and hours and hours and lots of money and all kinds of things on their cars. And you know what happens when they do that? They want to talk about it. They want to talk. You ever watched an interview with a football team that's engaged in tough discipline and they have faced tough opponents? You ever see them when they get behind a microphone as a team? Don't they tend to be a little bit outspoken? Or do they get behind the mic and just kind of go, well, I guess we'll do okay? No way. Hope. Hope, by definition, involves something that is unseen. It is the aspect of hope that makes it difficult for our human nature to maintain hope. It is something you can't look at. Romans 8:24, Paul says it this way, "For in this hope we were saved, but hope that is seen is no hope at all." Who hopes for what he already has? All right? Hope can't be hope if you've got it. Hope can't be hope if you see it. Sometimes we may lose hope for this very reason, and we sing about it, "Lord, haste the day when the faith shall be sight." Sure, after Jesus returns, after we've all been finished, changed, after it all has finally become reality, then we can be sure of it, but right now, we just don't see it. And Peter knows that's facing these people. Chapter 1, verse 8, he says about Jesus, "Right now, you don't see him." But remember, Christian hope is more than just wishful thinking. It's more than just a gamble with the odds in our favor. And while we may not see him, our hope isn't blind. Even the great prophets of old hoped in what they couldn't see, and they were told they wouldn't get to see it. Chapter 1, verse 21, he says, "Our faith and our hope are in God, because he raised Jesus from the dead, and he gave him glory." So our salvation this morning is certain, because it relies on that same power of God, the very same power that raised Jesus from the dead. It's not blind or foolish acceptance. It's hope that comes from God. Now, the power of that kind of hope, the certainty of such hope, ought to make us the most outspoken people on the face of the earth. Shouldn't it? Paul said in 2 Corinthians, "Since we have such a hope, we are very bold." Why has God made us a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession? I'll tell you why. Chapter 2, verse 9, "that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light," so you can be an outspoken person for him. Why bother keeping our behavior excellent among the Gentiles? Not just to shame them, but chapter 2, verse 12, "that they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation." If our hope in God is real, it shouldn't be hard to share. Look at 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. That we are supposed to, let me pull this up so I've got it in front of me better. We are supposed to always be prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for what? The hope that is in you. That's where our hope should be today. So real, so important, so strong that we will always be ready, always, to tell somebody, anyone, why we have that kind of hope. Outspokenness. That springs from the hope that God gives us. I want to ask you this morning, where has your hope in God taken you? It's taken many Christians bravely to be killed. It's taken the gospel into godless societies. Hope has taken awkward people to talk to their neighbors about Jesus. It has taken high school students to stand up and stick out at school. It's taken Central Christian Church people to places they weren't comfortable to do things that they wouldn't have otherwise done, all because their hope is in something greater than this life. I want to ask you this morning, what is hope producing in your life? What fruit is coming from the hope that God has given you? Todd is going to come here in just a moment. He's going to share a song with us today to help create for us a setting to deal with these questions. This song deals with a very real issue when it comes to your hope. Is it real? Does it answer this very most important question in life? You listen to that question today. You ask yourself, if hope is producing the fruit in your life that it should produce.